The views and opinions expressed on Geeks Under the Influence are that of the panelists and not of our sponsors, Amazon.com and TeePublic. Parental discretion is advised.
Not quite as playful as to say Danny Elfman, but...
Well, yeah.
Yeah, no, Danny Elfman definitely goes on the edge of, all right, this is just complete fun.
Like, well, that's what happens when you come from Oingo Boingo. Yeah. You're just a weird dude.
Did you see in the... Blue Harvest, Family Guy, Star Wars special thing they did where they made a joke about Danny Elfman doing the orchestration for Star Wars and how wildly different it was.
Mm. Yeah. I still would have, on a side note, I would have liked to have seen the David Lynch directed Return of the Jedi.
Oh man.
That would have been some shit.
I mean, that would have not felt like a Star Wars movie, I'll tell you that. It would have not felt like a Star Wars movie at all.
It would have been out there.
It would have been fucking out there. Yep.
Just do a double feature of Return of the Jedi and Dune. Yeah. And just have your brain hurt afterwards.
Oh. But did John Williams come back and do the first Jurassic World? I feel like he did.
Probably.
That would make the most sense.
He's a working dude.
Yeah. Well, I mean...
And the director for Jurassic World, I think that was Joe Johnson.
Could be.
He was the director?
The director. It wasn't Spielberg for Jurassic World.
No, he was just an executive producer or something.
But it is interesting that Spielberg and Williams are definitely like the prime example of directors that have a certain person they work with. Then there's also Tim Burton with Danny Elfman.
Yep.
Where Danny Elfman's done a bunch of stuff, but like almost anything that Burton touches, that Danny Elfman's on, you know, on the payroll.
Oh, absolutely. It's a good working relationships.
Mm-hmm. Well, for a lot of these soundtracks, these iconic soundtracks that we talk about mercilessly, is that there is a certain tone that the soundtrack really puts across. We've talked about Star Wars multiple times, that the soundtrack itself is like an additional character.
Absolutely.
Without it, you're not going to get nearly as much of the gravitas of the scene. And I've seen scenes from Star Wars with the instrumentation taken out, and it's totally different.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I was actually going to say that. Yeah, if you watch any of the special editions and the butchered versions of Star Wars, they take out the music score so we can hear more pew pew, pew, pew pew. That's literally why they take out some of the score in some of the scenes, and it just completely changes the tone of the movie.
Yeah.
Fucking terrible. Yeah, leave the man alone. He put it there for a reason. I mean, as far as composers go, like, he's one of the ones where that score was there for a reason. You know what I mean?
Well, if you can rely on one thing, it's going to be George Lucas is going to fuck up his earlier work later in his life. He fucking put CGI shit in THX-1138.
Yeah.
I was like, let me special a dish my first movie. Like, fuck you, dude.
Yeah, fuck off.
Piss off. Yeah.
But then there's even composers that an entire genre is you think about the soundtrack itself, like the Spaghetti Western would be nothing without Morricone's soundtracks.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's makes the genre.
And that man was a working man, too.
Oh, fuck yeah.
Like, his resume is, like, when he got the Lifetime Achievement, I want to say, like, 5-6 years ago at the Oscars, that's, like, one of the most earned freaking, like, accolades, because, man, he earned that shit. Like, there's so fucking many movies. Actually, one of my favorite, CD compilations is just a bunch of his random scores. And it has, like, the ones we all know from, like, the Man with No Name trilogy, you know, Spaghetti Western, but, like, there's so much other shit that he did, and it's just, like, that's awesome style, you know?
Yeah, I'll have to say that for him, though, the biggest thing I know is probably Ecstasy Gold. I mean,
oh, absolutely.
I don't really know him outside of that, so.
I mean, that's the kind of iconic, that's his... Imperial March.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
absolutely.
It's so iconically known. It's used in fucking Doritos commercials or whatever.
Well,
the fuck.
Metallica.
The fucking point when I was a child playing like cowboys and Indians, we used to mimic that song when we were doing it. Went to the point where Urban Struggle by the Vandals starts off with them doing a version of that song.
There you go, cowboy.
Yes.
I mean, it's the embodiment of, and that's kind of what we're going to get into on this episode of Geeks Under the Influence, episode 151. We're going to be talking about composers. We're going to be talking about instrumental soundtracks from different movies. and just how important they are to the tone and then the moving the plot forward in a lot of these films. So buckle up. We're going to be talking about the big hitters and also some interesting choices or musicians in their own right that are in bands or do, like, you know, non-instrumental stuff. They go in and start doing soundtracks. There's a few of them that I definitely want to touch on. So buckle up for this music-related episode where we will not be playing any of the music from the movies, but you know these things, these soundtracks, so deeply that it shouldn't be a problem. On episode 151, Composers and Soundtracks, welcome! Or for this one. Ay, ay, ay.
Yeah.
Ay, ay, ay.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah. That was even, I think that was what the Ramones used to come out to for live shows.
Really?
Was that, I know that it was incorporated at some point.
Wow.
I imagine that works. Yeah. I mean, they can come out to whatever the fuck they want to, because once they do 1, 2, 3, 4, you know, you're just in for the most awesome 25-minute show with 50 songs in it. Their entire discography in like half an hour.
Yeah. That's the best way to put it, where it's like somebody hit the fast forward button and it's like 2 hours of show just squeezed into 30 minutes.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is our 22nd song.
Really?
At the 5-minute mark.
Hell yeah, man.
Oh, shit.
But before we get into the soundtracks, that, I mean, there's such a wealth of stuff to talk about on this episode that I don't know why for a second I was worried about doing this episode without being able to play the music, but it's not going to be a problem. I mean, this is stuff that, like, is literally the soundtracks of our lives. Stuff that...
Oh, yeah.
You can't imagine, like, these movies without the extra character of the soundtrack. And here to talk about soundtracks and composers with me, to my right... is one of the two hosts of Beautiful Disasters, Mr. Grootz,
Yo. Sex
and Sandals, the German, is here.
The cinephile addict who has more scores on vinyl than he has actual, like, band records.
Yeah, it was a no-brainer to have you on this episode, because you have an absurd amount of soundtracks at your disposal.
They are... It brings back such nostalgia just to be able to listen to, you know, the Beetlejuice soundtrack or whatever the fuck it is. Because it's like watching the movie, but, you know, you can do other things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we talked about it on the Jurassic Park episode, but first CD that I ever bought was the Jurassic Park soundtrack.
There you go.
So I think that's what spurned this episode, was us talking about the soundtrack for Jurassic Park.
It was.
And yeah, and we were talking originally about doing a John Williams episode and decided to kind of widen it out and talk about multiple composers. So gentleman that I was having the conversation with on Jurassic Park is the next one up. My right-hand man on my left. Is Mr. Lowdown Brown MacGyver, the undertable jerker.
Oh, yeah. What's up, guys? Giggity.
The you know. Dry hand job pro over here. Yeah.
But yeah, that is exactly what brought it up, because, you know, we kind of went into that and Indiana Jones and Superman and, like, just all these scores, man. All these fucking scores that I hear today, and sometimes, depending on the right setting, like, a little tear in the eye, because I'm just like, it just brings it all back, man. First time you heard that, you know what I mean? First time you heard it, man. Oh, yeah.
When you think about stuff like the E.T. soundtrack, where it's like you have a nostalgic flashback, almost like PTSD, but for soundtracks, where you're just like driven back to your like early childhood, watching it with such like big eyes and just awe over this thing in front of you.
Oh, yeah. And the use of music. So perfect in there, you know, when E.T.'s dying, like, and they're trying to, like, zap him with the you know, the heart, you know, paddles and shit. That shit is dark, and the soundtrack is there to make you cry as a grown-ass man.
Yep. 100% correct. Yep. And the last person is here to talk about some amazing composers. It would be Hobbit, Mike the Hobbit Bigot. He's to my right. He is running this shite show as usual.
Also the one that's most likely to cry on an episode.
Very true. Very true.
It has happened before. And That's what I do love about soundtracks is the emotional response that it gives you. That, you know, death scenes in any movie, if there isn't the right soundtrack behind it, if there was fucking Skrillex playing while somebody's dying, there's not going to be nearly as much like emotional attachment to the scene.
Not unless it's Skrillex dying.
Unless it's actually Skrillex dying.
And then I'd be like, oh yes.
Yeah, but that's just tears of joy at that point. Yeah. Dubstep this motherfucker. But yeah, I am Mike the Hobbit, the founder of Geeks Under the Influence Network and the host of this. This fantastic, I'm excited for this episode, and you can find all of our other episodes, the other shows on the network, and information about events we're doing in town, all at GUIpodcast.com. I do want to make one quick announcement to all of our listeners. We're going to have more information rolling out here in the very near future, but we have been in talks with the new convention coming to Richmond, GalaxyCon, and four of the shows on the network are going to be having live shows at GalaxyCon at the end of May. It's May 31st through June 2nd at the Richmond Convention Center in town. And we're going to have a Geeks Under the Influence live show. We're going to have a Beautiful Disasters live show.
Fuck yeah.
A Geek Father live show and a Smack My Pitch Up live show. So it's going to be incredible. We're also going to be doing a panel on the adventures in podcasting. Where we're going to be talking about just kind of an intro to podcasting. If there's anybody interested in doing it, might field some basic questions about it or just help with figuring out how to come up with a concept for your own show. So definitely check that out. We're going to have plenty of information coming up in the near future on all of our social media and the website as well. So follow our social media. The links are at GYpodcast.com. And yeah, come out to the show. It's going to be an absolute blast. And definitely some crowd participation. So if you're a fan of GUI, you might be able to hear yourself asking questions and stuff on one of the four shows that are going to be on doing live recordings.
Fuck yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm very fucking excited.
I'm super fucking excited.
So fun. Oh, it's going to be so good.
Yeah. So yeah, we're going to definitely give you more information as it gets a little bit closer to the date. But right now we're going to focus entirely on the absolute phenomenal work of some of the like the most coveted composers. And a few little curveballs we're going to throw out here, too. There's definitely a few people I want to bring up. But first, I do want to kind of start with who we were talking with at first is John Williams. His his list of accolade soundtracks are just untouchable, really. I don't think there's ever been such a prolific soundtrack composer before.
I mean, he set the bar when it comes to adventure movies, and I mean, in the 80s, when he and Spielberg were collaborating so heavily, you had amazing works. I mean, Indiana Jones, like the sound, the scores to the Indiana Jones films is basically my idea of the adventure movie.
Oh yeah!
Oh,
yeah.
Absolutely!
Yeah. They're perfect. Every freaking note is perfect. You know, when it's supposed to be sad, it's sad or somber, or when it's action packed, it's fucking exhilarating.
I mean, every time I hear the main score from Indiana Jones, and I want to be serious with this, I just kind of want to go find a diamond somewhere, or a hidden gem.
Goddamn,
like you want to just go, man. Like, and that's what it's supposed to do, right? It wants to. You want to get put in that mindset where, like, yeah, we're gonna go on this adventure. We're gonna go find this and fight villains and
yeah. You kind of like, man, where's Richard Spencer so I can punch him in the face?
Right. But there's also just like with the spaghetti western when I was doing cowboys and Indians growing up. And you were, when we were doing action adventure shit running around the neighborhood, you're just running around. It was just part, it got into your DNA almost. There's something so attractive to these soundtracks that it's almost on a primal level that you identify with it.
Yep.
And that takes, I mean, deep talent. I mean, look at this, the list, and I'm not going to read them all, but like all the Star Wars movies, Jurassic Park, Schindler's List, talk about evoking like feelings.
Emotion, Jesus Christ.
Fucking Jaws.
Yep.
Such a simple little orchestration of just a couple notes that make it just terrifying.
I will say that his composition on Jaws is probably one of the main reasons why it stayed PG, because there are scenes in that movie where there's some really fucked up shit happening, and then the score is just making it lighthearted and like just fun. You know what I mean? Like, it's fucking awesome.
That is still one of the best horror movies of all time.
Yep. Rated PG, guys.
Rated PG.
Make sure you kids watch it.
Titties.
titties.
Titties. In the first minute of the movie. You're like, yeah.
Big ones. They're bouncing everywhere.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Lord.
Yeah, and I think that's why, you know, you end up with this double team as Spielberg and Williams, because there's, just like Williams, Spielberg, at an almost primal level, it hits these notes of just real pure, like the innocence of childhood kind of approach to something epic. You're mm-hmm. able to see it through a child's eyes. And as, even when there's not really children involved, like in Jurassic Park, when they see dinosaurs for the first time, there's a feeling of awe and wonder on you know, Sam Neill's face as he's like pulling his glasses off and looking at these dinosaurs. And then the John Williams soundtrack just slowly, smoothly transitions in. And it's this moment of like absolute respect and wonderment. And it's, oh.
Every time I see it with my wife, our dog gets to feast on her tears. Because, you know, that's one of the things. Like, Jurassic Park was probably one of the most formative, like, movies of her youth. And to this day, when I got her the, the soundtrack on vinyl from Mondo, they friggin', like, it just creates this emotional response. Like, she's not even watching the movie, and she's bawling.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's so, like, and you might remember when I got married to this woman 5 years ago, you know, 5+ years ago, the music that we put together for our actual, like, you know, the whole shindig, you know, the cocktail hour, the ceremony, everything was basically movie scores.
Yeah.
And it just worked so perfectly. You know, we didn't need to have a live band or, you know, play the fucking Macarena or whatever the hell they do these days.
No, but even the like actual songs that were in there were oftentimes songs from, like, I think we walked into like Little Green Bag from
the Reservoir, from Dogs, Reservoir Dogs, and we were dressed up like the Reservoir Dogs.
Yeah.
So. And it was fucking awesome. Yeah, exactly. You know, and
I felt so fucking baller, us rolling in nice suits to Little Green Bag and just kind of strutting.
Those black and white photos are still like some of my favorite shots.
Oh, hell yeah.
Of us. But but I will say, you know, very, very briefly, you know, we're mostly talking about composers here, but there is something to be said about, you know, people that work on films that arrange fantastic soundtracks of different songs.
Well, it's like James Gunn did with the Guardian soundtracks.
Absolutely. It's
absolutely stellar, or the Crow soundtrack. I mean, that's, I think, a good thing for us to approach on GUI Nights, which will be
a
little supplement for the next week. So we'll, if you want to hear us talking about our favorite like soundtracks with actual compiling of different songs, just next week.
We'll get into that.
Yeah, we'll have
touch on that. Yeah, info. There's a lot.
There's a lot, there. Yeah. So, but John Williams, like, we could definitely do an hour on just John Williams.
And, oh, easy.
But it would just be us, like, literally just, like, verbally jerking off about John Williams' soundtrack.
And I do agree. And there's tons of other composers, you know, throughout cinema history that we definitely need to touch on. One thing one thing from John Williams is probably my favorite out of all the things he's done. And it's the, I don't remember the name of the score, but it's the score in Star Wars. And the first time you hear it is in Star Wars. And it's like when nothing's going wrong, but like Luke looks into the distance when you first meet him,
the sun setting. Yep.
And that, oh my God, that still sends chills. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like it's like so beautiful.
When a score is utilized perfectly, it can absolutely set scene. It can establish character. It can do all these things without having to have a single line of dialogue. And that exact scene that you're talking about says everything. You find out everything you need to know about young Luke Skywalker's situation. He's on this desert world. He doesn't want to, you know, he wants to be out. He wants to go live his life. He wants to join the rebellion, be a, you know, all these things. But he's stuck at home with his aunt and uncle and working on fucking, you know, moisture evaporators or whatever the fuck, you know. Yeah.
Well, that scene alone, if you just heard, let's say, a light breeze sound as he's looking, you didn't know if, like, he was looking for something. Or, you know, you didn't get real tone of what was happening. It was just looking off in the distance, like CW style. But with the, like, forlorn music in the background, you get an idea that he's, like, he's looking into his future. It's longing that he has simply because of the soundtrack. Without it, there's confusion. If you heard, like, crickets in the background, it's like, Is he seeing how much time before it's nighttime? Like, what's what is he doing? Right. Did he see a deer? Like, what is happening in the scene? But the music completely informs the audience.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah,
I'm happy to hear that. Like, everyone else got from that the same thing. That's exactly what I'm saying. As far as for music defining a character development and scene, like, that's everything. Everything right there.
And I think we've talked a lot about Star Wars over the years. You know, my wife didn't end up actually seeing it until she was an adult, like in her late 20s or something. So, you know, in a sense that you know,
poor woman.
I know. So she's never been a big Star Wars fan, probably because of that reason. Because there's a time and place when you should see it, and it's when you have. When you're looking through the eyes of wonderment as a child, basically, and you see this adventure, and it's sweeping epic going on, the music is there, the characters are there. Yeah, you can step back from it and analyze it, you know, like as a film, and be like, okay, yeah, there's some wooden acting and blah 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 blah, but everything together is why that's a magical movie.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I had the same experience with an old roommate of mine that we watched Superman, and he had never seen a Superman 1 or 2. Before the original ones. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, I love those movies. I saw them when I was a kid, and I actually chipped a tooth when I was a child, jumping off stairs, pretending to be Superman.
Oh, that's a good one for Kyle. We got to let him know that.
I had a cap on one of my baby teeth, like front teeth, because I jumped. And apparently just because you believe it doesn't make it happen. Just a little note to yourself there.
That's Peter Pan.
Is Peter Pan. Yeah, not Superman. But I was an idiot kid in my preschool, just jumped off fucking steps, convinced I could fly. And
so, hell yeah.
But I had such a love for these movies from my childhood, the nostalgia of it. And then I watched it with him as he was an adult watching it for the first time. He thought it was cheesy bullshit. And watching it next to him, I could see where he was getting that from this movie, because it is pretty cheesy.
Oh, yeah. But, it is.
But I watched it when a lot of the stuff that I would see cheesy now didn't matter at that age. You know, right. it was not an issue. So it made me kind of give my nephews a little bit more of an easy go when they talk about the prequels aren't that bad. That I'm like, no, yes, they are. But I keep that to myself because they were children when they first saw it. I was an adult, you know.
Yeah. No, that's fair. That is fair. Because we're watching it through, I guess you could say, like a jaded version of what they're watching it through, because they're watching through the wonderment, and what we saw through the wonderment, like, isn't, you know what I mean, isn't the same thing. So I get that.
It's like that movie line is like, when you saw the Star Wars, I was already a man, you know.
I was born in it.
I was born in it.
But
molded by it.
Speaking of which, that's a good turnover to the next composer I like to bring up, is fucking Hans Zimmer, who did the music for Dark Knight and The Dark Knight Rises.
Yep. And he's, I wouldn't say as iconic as John Williams, but he's up there. Like, he's one of the, like, top three conversation.
John Williams is the king A-dog of all, you know, famous movie composers at this point.
Well, point that kids found his house and, like, played a tuba, Star Wars music through tuba and, like, trumpet out front of his house. And he came out and, like, talked to them about music and said, you know, this is actually really flattering. Like, don't come back to my house, but, like, this is pretty cool.
Yeah. Get off my lawn.
Yeah. Get off my lawn. Politely. Like, that's really cool. You know, stay in school, do the music stuff. That's really rad. I'm glad that my stuff resonated with you, but
forget my address.
Forget my address. Don't come back, but cool. But yeah, Hans Zimmer's up there too, as far as, like, just iconic.
Yeah, I would. Yeah, yeah, definitely.
I mean, even, like, as far as going current, man, I mean, we're talking, like, he did Avengers. He did Pirates of the Caribbean. Sure. I mean, Da Vinci Code. I want to go through the whole list, but things that matter to me, with the Dark Knight trilogy, that music from that movie. I mean, if you're going to have somebody to try to just do a different version of what Elfman had created in the Burton Batman, like, okay, he nailed it out of the park. You know,
yeah.
The scores for that trilogy were amazing because they fit that tone of that movie, right?
They do, yeah. And I would say, you know, definitely Hans Zimmer. James Horner was huge. I mean, these are all, like, I mean, nobody touches John Williams.
Yeah, no.
But, you know, they're right below, because so many of the movies that we know and love are all by sometimes the same top 5 or 10 guys.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I will say, though, this is Nolan's guy. Okay. Yeah. Because, like, I didn't realize this until now, but part of the reason I did love this movie so much was because of the soundtrack. Fucking Interstellar. I did not know he was a composer for that. Now it makes so much sense.
Didn't Hans Zimmer did Inception as well.
Yeah, he did Inception as well. And that soundtrack definitely set the tone for all those dream sequences.
Yes, we had the layers of it and everything.
Oh, man.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So that's a... I give that the same respect because it's not just, like... A lot of things Williams did, it enhanced the story, but it was a lot of action, a lot of scene setting as far as that time period, right? But like, you know, Hans Zimmer, he went a little bit of a different route with his kind of.
I would agree with that. A lot of people, I think the main works that we all know that John Williams did, the big iconic blockbuster movies that we all know, obviously eclipse a lot of his other works, which a lot of times he was still doing with Spielberg, like Empire of the Sun,
mm-hmm.
and even Munich. I think he did the score for Munich, which was a smaller movie, you know, that Spielberg did. But, you know, when you look at the resume, you know, his ability to construct, you know, scores for different kinds of movies, I mean, that's why he's at the top of the game, man.
Yeah, I will never take that from him. But I mean, you got Horner.
Yep.
Braveheart.
Well, I do want to also bring up that one thing that I thought was kind of out of the ballpark for Zimmer primarily and was kind of almost mimicking another composer is he did Blade Runner 2049.
Yes.
Oh.
But he crushed it.
And he was doing it kind of in the style of Vangelis, that's who did the original.
I think there was so much homage, but it also was its own thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes. And yeah. I like that it wasn't even musical at some points where it was those hard bangs and crashes that weren't even like there was no melody to it, but it just still really informed the scenes like deeply.
It was, yeah, I agree. It was very percussive. That's
very percussive.
Very percussive. Yeah. Very jarring.
It actually reminded me of the Akira soundtrack.
Yes. Mm. Yes.
Which used a lot of like know, like just different. Yeah, it wasn't what we would traditionally think of as like a musical score, but it definitely added so much like just gravity to the scenes, and like it really set you in the place.
It gave the scenes texture.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Like it really filled out the environment deeply. Mm-hmm. And I was, when I found out it was Hans Zimmer that did the soundtrack, I was deeply impressed because of course it's Hans Zimmer. So like, it's going to be a decent soundtrack, but this was definitely not playing his strong suits in this. I mean, he was playing with somebody else's toys almost, you know, in that composition, and he did a fantastic job.
Yeah.
It felt appropriate. It felt almost seamless with the Vangelis soundtrack from the original, which that is another iconic soundtrack, is the original Blade Runner soundtrack.
Absolutely. Oh, yeah. Oh, beautiful.
Yeah, that movie still, yeah, that's still my response when someone asks you the impossible question, what's your favorite movie? And I always just say, fucking Blade Runner.
Well, because you love the noir, you love the sci-fi, and that is hard sci-fi.
Oh, it is. Yeah. And it's dark. It's just everything that's awesome. But I was just looking at John Williams' resume here. He did that fucking movie Heartbeats.
The fucking Andy Kaufman vehicle? Yes. Jesus.
Really?
Yeah, dude. This man works every year on his resume, especially through the 70s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s. He has like 5 movies a year, at least.
Jesus.
The man worked.
Yeah.
Jesus.
And it sounds like he's like also at least doing like some quality stuff. I'm looking at Horner's work, and there's things that definitely I love that he did, like Braveheart, Titanic, and Fuck Off. But the music for Beautiful Mind, I will say, that definitely set the tone for that movie. That movie is dark as fuck, and the music definitely makes it depressing and very dark.
Like,
and
all these composers are going to do stuff just to get a paycheck.
Exactly.
I mean, Hans Zimmer did the fucking soundtrack for Boss Baby.
Oh.
And you know, he didn't put his heart into that.
No, he's like, I'm just going to.
This is going to be my fucking opus, is Boss Baby.
This ain't no Heartbeats.
But, yeah, it's no Heartbeats. I feel like I left everything on the field for Heartbeats.
My blood and sweat and tears was in that. Holy shit. But another one from Horner that, again, helped the movie, Cocoon, man. Like, the soundtrack definitely brought that movie out,
even just to go back and say something about Titanic, like, it's a big, sappy, James Cameron epic movie, right? But there's a reason why that movie made a gajillion dollars, is because the soundtrack or the score perfectly fit the film. It was a romance, you know, like I don't have it in me to watch that movie.
Yeah.
You know,
I had to watch it. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, you know, we all had to.
I remember getting yelled at because of that movie, because my sister had her friends over and they were watching Titanic, and it's the scene where the ship's sinking and there's people falling off the boat and one person hits the
propeller,
and spins off, and I started fucking dying laughing and grabbed the remote and kept rewinding it. So it was like bang, whoop. And then down again, pop, spin into the water, rewind, bing, and kept doing that, laughing my ass off as my sister is bawling, like, Mike, stop! As they're just like crying, really in this emotional moment, and I'm fucking cackling.
Because that shit is funny.
Oh, it's funny as shit.
That shit is funny.
Oh, my God.
But yeah, there are, I mean, and, you know, Horner did have his one big action adventure. I mean, he did Jumanji, which that music was pretty fun. Freaking sweet. Yeah. It was fun, you know. But there are some bad ones, though. I mean, yeah, no. Deep Impact, no.
Hey,
he did crawl though. So that's fun.
I did like Deep Impact better than fucking Armageddon.
Yeah, that dude. That's not comparing it to shit. Okay, Armageddon was a terrible movie.
It was.
It was a terrible movie.
What was I?
I don't want to close my eyes. Whatever.
Oh, yeah, no, don't even. It's a cool man. You can totally fuck up the words. Yeah, no, it doesn't matter.
No, you know, I was riffing with some of my coworkers the other day, and fucking Armageddon came up, and motherfucker said some funny ass shit where he was just like, you know what? There is no world in which you would trade a fucking Bruce Willis for a Ben Affleck. That's fucking bullshit.
No shit. Yes, that is right on the money, though, for real.
Motherfucker drew the short straw, leave his ass on the goddamn asteroid.
Oh, that's very true, though. Yeah, I would not.
But then we wouldn't have gotten Batfleck.
Oh, that was worth it.
Yeah, totally.
But another one, you got Aliens. Hey, Horner did that.
That's right.
Cameron, yeah.
Who did Alien?
Yeah, who did Ridley Scott?
I will look into that. But like, yeah. Aliens, yeah, that's talk about an iconic soundtrack. Oh,
yeah. Fuck yeah, man. I think that was the good person to pick the turn to make it the more action movie. You know what I mean? Because yeah, whoever did the original Alien definitely had a more suspenseful.
Well, and I want to say about him. And I don't know if it was the same guy, and I wish I had done research on this, but we had during the 80s and 90s, we had these particular action flicks, you know, sort of sci-fi action flicks, which had like this really almost industrial, you know, like the T2. Dur, dur, dur,
dur, dur. Yes.
And then you had that shit on like fucking Total Recall, and you had that shit on fucking.
Who was that, though?
I don't know.
Actually, Total Recall is the same person that Alien, Jerry Goldsmith.
There it is.
Yeah.
Jerry Goldsmith.
Yeah, he also did L.A. Confidential, Star Trek what? First Contact. What? Yeah, so this is one of those like lesser-known composers, like more popularly known,
I would say.
He did
both Terminator?
I'm taking a look now, but...
Holy shit.
He is...
What else
did he do? He did Looney Tunes Back in Action. So
did he do RoboCop as well?
I'm taking a look, so he might be a Verhoeven guy.
He could be.
He did Star Trek Nemesis, Sum of All Fears, Hollow Man, 13th Warrior, The Haunting, The Mummy, Deep Rising, Mulan, Small Soldiers, U.S. Marshals, Air Force One.
You say The Omen and Gremlins.
Air Force One. That definitely had like a... Dun, 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 you know, it's like
he did The Omen and Gremlins.
Oh, sweet.
He did Chain Reaction.
Fucking Gremlins, dude.
First Blood. That makes sense, because that music
yeah.
on First Blood is so reminiscent of Terminator and Total Recall.
He did fucking Congo, which has a great soundtrack.
Oh, it does.
Yeah.
Dude. Wow.
And
dude.
The Ghost in the Darkness. He did First Night, Powder. I mean, this dude has done a ton of
I can't remember
movies.
The soundtrack for Powder, though.
Yeah, no. Like,
a movie's just so depressing.
Well,
he did The Shadow. Holy crap.
I mean, you know, albinos, man. Like, what the fuck?
Yeah. Well, also, it was directed by that dude that was, like, charged multiple times with fucking, like, kiddie porn and like, child molestation.
The guy who directed Jeepers Creepers 3? Yeah.
Yeah, that guy.
That guy.
Oh, man.
Dude, this guy did the soundtrack for Mom and Dad Save the World.
That movie's awesome.
That movie is awesome. Yeah.
Fucking John Lovitz, dude.
Yeah, this guy has done it. He did Gremlins 2, so he probably did Total Recall, Leviathan, The Burbs, Warlock.
Ooh, Patton.
Rambo 3.
He did Patton. Fuck yeah, dude. Patton.
Rudy. He did fucking Rudy.
Is this Jerry Goldsmith?
Yeah.
Yeah, this guy is... I'm actually surprised that I don't know this composer more, because he's done so much. He did Explorers.
Yay! Yeah, like, I love that movie.
And Legend.
Logan's Run.
Legend. But, of course, Legend.
And Gremlins.
Yeah. Legend. Yep. There was the alternate soundtrack with Tangerine Dream.
Yeah, true.
For Legend.
He did the fucking Supergirl movie.
Oh, my God.
Dude.
Does anybody else remember that movie? Oh,
still better than the fucking bullshit that Zack Snyder was putting out.
Did Poltergeist.
I don't know about that.
Secret of NIMH.
Ooh, Secret of NIMH. I fucking
So basically, if it wasn't Hans Zimmer or John Williams, it was this guy, apparently.
Basically.
Or Danny Elfman.
Apparently, man. Wow. Okay.
Yeah, this guy's all did the original Star Trek movie. 2001
Space Odyssey.
Yep.
Wow, that's crazy.
Yeah, he's done so much. Holy hell.
Hell yeah, man. Nice. So,
yeah, Logan's Run. Okay, we got to stop just listing stuff. Yeah. That's not...
But no, but I mean, these
I'm surprised on the episode that, like, I had no idea this guy was so prolific.
Wow.
So,
man.
Yeah, that's good to know.
Fuck yeah.
So, that is actually a good time for us to stop for our break.
Yes.
When we come back, you're going to hear about some trivia nights and stuff like that. And when we come back, we're going to go over what we're drinking, maybe a drunken scene, and then get into, well, we need to hit it on Danny Elfman big time on the second half.
Oh, yeah. No, I got a couple composers that we really need to talk
about. I got at least one that we're definitely going to hit on.
Oh, yeah.
You guys know who it is, too, I'm sure. Because he's my man.
Oh, yeah. No, I kind of figured that would come up.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm jerking on that all second half.
Yeah, absolutely. So prepared for a jerk fest on the second half of this episode, all about soundtracks and composers. We'll be right back. This is Mike the Hobbit, direct from Fallout on a trivia night, telling you to come here every first and third Monday for trivia between 8 and 10, 25-cent wings, drink specials, prizes, and tons of really inappropriate trivia. It's a lot of fun. Do you guys agree? Definitely come out and enjoy trivia every first and third Monday at Fallout. We're back for the second half of Geeks Under the Influence, all things composers and soundtracks. We've talked a lot about John Williams and Hans Zimmer and several other composers. Before we continue on talking about Danny Elfman and a couple Dark Horse candidates for fantastic compositions for films and television, we're going to get into our sponsors very briefly here. Of course, our oldest sponsor on Geeks Under the Influence is Amazon.com. You go to Amazon for the soundtracks that you love so deeply and the movies that the soundtracks come from and everything else that you need in your life. I just recently picked up fucking butt wipes from Amazon myself because after watching the bonus features from Deadpool 2, where the director has this weird thing that he threw into Deadpool 2 about like how wet wipes are really important. I was like, I have enjoyed the times that I've used wet wipes at conventions and stuff when you know you're going to have some terrible food and booze. And I've incorporated that into my life, and it's a much better life for it. And I was able to get good quality and low cost wet wipes for my butt at Amazon.com.
Hygiene is important.
Yes.
Thanks, Amazon.
And what's more important is making sure that you are supporting Geeks Under the Influence with your wet wipe butt wipe purchases. So, well, every time you wipe your ass, you know that a little bit of that money you spent on that wet wipe for your asshole is going to Geeks Under the Influence. So... Lowdown is not really digging this promo.
You can also get condoms, guys. So, you know, you could also, like, be putting your dick in random places and know that some of that money that's protecting you from STDs is going to GUI.
See, that's way better, actually.
Like that?
That was a better angle, I think. Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah. So, with every pump into some rando that you picked up at the bar, you can...
I really hope Jeff Bezos listens to this episode. Maybe he'll give us a grant.
Oh, shit. Holy fuck.
We're currently looking into getting Geeks Under the Influence condoms. No, we're not.
Dude, we can have fun with that, though.
Fuck us or die.
Yes.
Or fuck with or die is the instructions on the condom.
Yeah.
But yeah, so Amazon.com, all you'd have to do is go to the link in the top right corner of GUIpodcast.com on the homepage. And when you go through that link, bookmark it, clear your cache and bookmark it, and anything you purchase through that link moving forward, we get a little bit from it. So it's a way to support our booze, our storage fees, equipment stuff, everything that goes along with running this podcast. And we would deeply appreciate it. Every little bit does help. So our other sponsors... is something where you get something in addition to you are purchasing your support of this podcast with merch. That's right, T Public, we have teamed up with to have merch for all the different podcasts on the network, inside jokes, and designs by fans and friends and members of the shows at GUIpodcast.com. So you can get a GUI shirt, you can get a Beautiful Disaster shirt, you can get a Smack My Pitch Up shirt, or any of the other shows on the network. There's even a shirt with me, duct tape over my mouth, says Shut the Fuck Up, Hobbit. There's Y'all Motherfuckers Need Odin. We left the Lovecraft GUI design from Halloween Up because it was a pretty good seller. It did relatively well. People loved the design, so we decided to keep that up there just as a permanent feature on there. But we do have occasional holiday stuff. Like, we had two Halloween designs that aren't on the site anymore. We might bring them back next Halloween along with some new designs. We're going to try to have some special event ones drawn up for, you know, conventions that we are involved with, or, you know, or just limited time stuff as well. And you can find that and phone cases, stickers, all sorts of stuff available through our TeePublic page that you can find at GUIpodcast.com/store. And there will be a link to the TeePublic store right on that page. And and also we have merch only available at our live events, whether it be trivia or any kind of special events we do. We have hats for $15. We've got koozies that say, hey, we're fucking drinking on them. And we've got stickers all available at any of the GUI events. So definitely come out, support us on any of our live events or trivia, and buy a sticker, koozie, maybe a hat, and show your love for the network.
Fuck you.
Yeah. I've gotten so many shirts now where I can almost like wear nothing but Geeks Under the Influence shirts, but I'm not that much of a fucking shameless self.
Yes, you are.
That is a lie. Yeah, I'm definitely that level of.
I'm going to call you on that real quick.
Yeah, real quick.
Yes, you are.
Oh, shit.
To the point where our friends are like, oh, you have a podcast? Okay, I get it. I talk about it. No, tell me about that. Do you have merch? Yeah, okay, I'll stop. I'm sorry.
So, yeah, this is the thing.
And it's a big part of my life. But
I get it. We get it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
I own tons of GUI merch.
I love that my friends fucking just deal with me. It's it's appreciated.
I got a new hard hat. So, sad to say, Anthony, that awesome sticker, RIP. I had to get a new hard hat.
It happens.
But I got a lot of comments on that sticker. It's like, what is that? I'm like, oh, it's the big three is Run DMC. It's pretty sweet.
Fuck yeah.
Hell yeah.
But anyway, now it's full of GUI stickers.
Nice.
Fucking.
That's what goes on.
Hell yeah. All right, so that's our sponsors. Now let's get into what is driving the fuel that drives this podcast, which is the booze. We're going to talk about what we're drinking.
Hey, we're fucking drinking. We're getting drunk. You want to know? Well, here you go. Hey.
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 We'll never get tired of that.
Nope.
Ever.
What a fucking goober.
I need to get some more remixes going of that. By the way, if there's any composers, speaking of the subject matter, in the listenership that wants to do some remixes of Kyle Smash's Hey, We're Fucking Drinking, there's a still a version without the music on the GUI stream that you can find, or if you have trouble finding it, just send an email and I can send it your way. It's a short little audio clip, and throw some remix in there. We'll play it on the episodes.
Hey, you know, that'll be the only way I'll ever tolerate Skrillex. Come on, man. Bring your game, dude.
Skrillex, bring your fucking dubstep game to Hey, We're Fucking Drinking. Also, I was thinking that we wouldn't be bad for us to have a sponsors intro. So if anybody out there wants to do something, whatever, for our sponsors intro, that would be appreciated as well.
Nice.
So, all right, now what we're drinking, Lowdown was nice enough to bring some shares for us.
I was.
And these are both from the same brewery, correct?
They are. I went to Triple Crossing Brewery. I went to their Fulton location. They have two locations in Richmond, one's downtown and one's in Fulton Hill, yesterday. And they have can releases every Friday. And two of the four that came out this week, one was called Rolling Blackouts, and it is their Imperial Stout. Now, this is coming from a place who doesn't do a lot of darker beers, you know? They do specialize in the New England-style IPAs and a couple West
like
Coast
Falcon
IPAs.
Falcon Smash is their big one.
God damn it, and it's fucking good.
Oh, it is good.
It's delicious. It is. So one of the ones I brought was Rolling Blackouts, which is their 10% Imperial Stout. And, I mean, it's just dark chocolatey cherry goodness. It's fucking amazing. Smooth, definitely a dick kicker. And the other one I brought was a variant of the Falcon Smash, and it's called the Nelson Falcon. And basically, it's the same core as the Falcon Smash, but it's double dry hopped, and they introduce grapes to the mix.
Hmm.
Oh, okay.
And it's very, it's still hearty. You know, it's like at 7%, I believe it's, yeah. Yeah.
7%. Do they say where they acquire the grapes? I'm thinking maybe it might be from vineyards in Nelson County, which would make sense.
That would.
Oh, it would. But they do not say that on the can, but that would actually
that
make.
That would make the most sense.
A lot of sense, yes.
And I mean, a lot of these breweries want to work with like regionally local and not regionally local as in East Coast local, like we say on here, but like actually nearby.
Like Hardywood, they source a lot of their ingredients locally because, I mean, who else is going to support local but local, man?
Yeah,
that's what you got to keep
absolutely.
It with, man.
Goddamn local right. support, local.
But both these beers are really awesome. I enjoy them both. And any chance I have to, again, support a local brewery that's making a delicious beer, I will do that.
And Rolling Blackout, that's a 10%er, I think, right? You said? Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it is real smooth for a 10%er. I mean, it's got almost like a chocolatey kind of mouthfeel to it.
Yeah.
It's dark, but it's not super heavy. I mean, it's definitely got some viscosity to it. It's got some... but it's not quite to a chewy level, you know. It's not motor oil. It's good. Well, I really like the texture of it, and I wouldn't go far to say it's sessionable. That's where you actually start having rolling blackouts.
No, if you drink one of these, you're good. You don't need any more than that.
Yeah, and I haven't tried the other one here. This is the Nelson Falcon.
Yes, the Nelson Falcon.
So it's basically the regular Falcon Smash with grapes.
Yeah, and I don't know where they I would like to know where they acquired the grapes from, but it's also double dry hopped, so it's got double the hops they use to make the juicy fruitness that
and,
you get from.
You know, not being a terribly big IPA fan for the most part, at least not the like the heavy hopped IPAs, this is borderline of where I like it's not. Overwhelming. I could definitely drink this and be perfectly content. But it's like right at the top tier of my level of appreciation for hops. Much more than this, and that would go into the like, I don't like it.
No, and I get that. For me, like what I get is not initially, but at the back end of it, I just taste fruit juice.
Ooh, yeah, the fruit is really prevalent on the finish there. Yeah.
See? And that really deters me. I mean, and that really draws me because the deterrent for me is the overly hopped. It's dry. It's bitter. This, it's just like
you get citrus almost,
all like, pineapple and like
so pineapple good. Definitely. Yeah,
it's so good. Nice. I fucking love it, man.
Well, neither of you have long enough mustaches to do like the waxing, so you know that much hops just doesn't suit your.
Yeah,
character.
That's true. Not enough handlebar here for us. Now, Groots, you're drinking on something. Tasty.
I am also drinking East Coast local.
There you go.
Virginia local. This is Macaulay's Virginia Bourbon.
Ooh.
And it's actually probably my favorite Virginia whiskey outside of some of the Bowman Brothers releases.
They've got some fantastic
which
releases.
Which are outstanding as well. But yeah, this comes out of Evington, which is Campbell County. It's a little bit south of Nelson, like a couple counties down, I think. But I discovered this... like a year or two ago, just randomly at one of the ABC stores. And I was like, oh, Virginia, $36. Let me give it a go.
Oh, that's not bad for that size bottle.
Not at all.
No.
Yeah. I mean, it's basically the same price as Bullet.
Yeah. And, okay. That's good to know.
You know, it's actually really tasty. So, we'll make sure we get some shares here in a little bit.
Yeah
I would love to try that.
Yeah. I definitely want to
taste
$36
bucks a bottle. Yeah. I'm down for that.
Yeah. It's good.
Yeah. So.
I always love it when there's a few shares and all of them are good.
Yes.
Right. I hate when I have to begrudgingly be like, especially if it's a brewery I enjoy, going, you missed the mark. And luckily, we do not have any of those this episode.
Right.
These are all tasty beverages.
I'm telling you, that Nelson Falcon, that fruit.
Actually,
just...
I'm even warming up to it even more now as I've had a few sips. And I think partly because we had the darker one first. This is very, this could, you could session.
Yeah, you could. You
could definitely session.
Now, it is 7%, so.
Make sure you're where you're staying when you session it.
But it's just so, I mean, I'm not a hop person, and these are the IPAs I like. I like the juicy, the fruit forward hops, because it's not like I'm sucking on a Christmas tree's asshole.
That's a good way to put it, yeah.
Yeah. That's as eloquent as I can get with it. That's all I got.
Snorting bong water?
Yeah.
Dude, pretty much. Oh, it's fucking terrible, man. This is it's sweet. It's so delicious. It's so good.
Speaking of terrible, that is exactly what we're going into. Some people's favorite and some people's least favorite part of the podcast. We're talking about making a drunken scene.
Making a drunken scene.
Meh. This was actually kind of a difficult call on what to do for this episode because what are we going to do, like a fucking a cappella version of like a Star Wars song or something? Like, how do you do Drunken Scene for a soundtracks and composers episode? So I figured the best way to do it is to talk about a composer, talk about a movie that involves composition and involves music in general. And one of my favorites in that genre of films is Mr. Holland's Opus.
Yes.
There you go.
Yeah, it's a great film. Movie. And it was either that or August Rush, which I deeply enjoy, but it's not everybody's cup of tea.
Amadeus, damn it.
Never seen
it. Or Amadeus.
Well, yeah, there you go.
Mm-hmm.
So we're doing a scene between Glenn Holland, who's played by, what's his fuck?
Richard Dreyfuss.
Richard Dreyfuss,
man. We talk about Jaws, damn.
Yeah, no shit, right? Well, fuck me, right?
Fuck you, man.
Mr. Holland's Opus from 1995, that Glenn Holland is the main character. And then we've got Principal Jacobs and Vice Principal Gene Walters. Now, we haven't figured out who's playing what on this. Is there any specifics of who wants to play what?
I'll do whatever. I'll do the principal. It's fine.
I can do vice principal.
Okay, and I'll do Glenn Holland.
There we go.
You can do that. There we go.
So it starts off with Principal Jacobs. This is Mr. Holland's Opus from 1995.
Mr. Holland, it has come to my attention that you are teaching the students the rock and roll.
Is this a problem?
Is this a problem? Yes, I think so. Our only job is to teach. We cannot teach, and the students cannot learn if there is no discipline.
Fuck.
I'm sorry. What exactly is your point, Gene?
My point is rock and roll in its very nature leads to a breakdown in discipline.
It's like Mr. Ed meets Paul Bearer. Jesus.
Well, what would you like me to do? Deny that rock and roll exists?
What we are saying is that you should be pushing the classics. Brahms, Mozart, Stravinsky.
Stravinsky was the music of the Russian Revolution. If you want to talk about breakdown in discipline.
You are deliberately exaggerating.
How about the Kingston Trio, Gene? How about Sing Along with Mitch?
Oh, please.
Just a minute, Mr. Gentleman. Mr. Holland, I do not want to interfere in the curriculum of any teacher, but next week I have a meeting with the school board, and there are people in this community who believe that rock and roll is a message sent from the devil himself.
Ooh.
Now, when that issue comes up, what can I tell them?
Mrs. Jacobs.
Oh, Mrs. Okay.
Mrs. Jacobs, you tell them that I am teaching music and that I will use anything from Beethoven to Billie Holiday to rock and roll if I think it'll help me teach a student to love music.
All right, so we got like, you can't have any more pudding if you don't eat your meat. Meets Paul Bearer and Mr. Ed, and then fucking Revenge of the Nerds going at it.
That was hilarious.
Solid.
Oh, Jesus.
Holy shit. All right.
All right, back to the subject at hand, which, of course, is soundtracks and composers. And best way to get into the second part of this episode is to talk about one of my personal favorites. It's basically the really deeply, along with Williams, like the soundtrack to my childhood, because it was all over Burton stuff. We're talking Danny Elfman.
Fuck. Yeah. Yes.
Originally started as the lead singer of the iconic band from the 80s, Oingo Boingo.
Fuck yeah.
Even
weird as shit.
Yeah, you want weird as shit, watch Forbidden Zone.
I love Forbidden.
I fucking love.
He plays Satan.
He plays fucking Satan. And it's so unbelievably not able to be remade in this day and age, that movie.
Oh, no.
There's like deeply upsetting and jarring and edgy shit in that movie.
Yeah, dude. And what was it? Hervé Villechaize, Knickknack or whatever, from James Bond. He was the fucking king.
Yeah, he was the king of the Forbidden Zone, yeah.
Which, by the way, I want to see that biopic where little dude from Game of Thrones plays him.
Peter Dinklage?
Yeah, there was a big blowback on that because they were saying that he was whitewashing the character because the dude was like Taiwanese or something, and then Peter Dinklage is like, no, actually, I've talked with the family. He was like French. So you're wrong. And so
exactly,
people that were trying to point out whitewashing in Hollywood, we're actually misidentifying the person they were trying to defend.
Hey, you know what? At least they didn't get Gary Oldman to play the character.
That's true.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
Tiptoes, talk about like, I mean, there's plenty of like, you know, little midget people out in the fucking world that are ready to fucking play a role. And they got Gary Oldman to play midget.
Yeah.
Midget face.
Yeah. Tiptoes is the name of the movie. It's got Matthew McConaughey, I think, is in it as well. And Bridget the Midget is in it.
Yeah. Yeah.
As well.
Peter Dinklage is in that movie.
Yeah. And that's it's an odd flick. It's worth checking out for sure.
It's a thing that happened.
Yeah, that is correct.
And there is nothing worse than fucking Gary Oldman in giant forehead, like midget, like
and also just like acting on his literally on his knees.
Prosthetics. Yeah. It's like, dude, that's fucked up.
I was going to say, man, for me, Danny Elfman has got two big ones. And obviously, I think it's all for the same of us is the OG Tim Burton's Batman. That fucking score.
Oh, God.
The greatest Batman movie ever made.
I mean, unless I love the Christopher Nolan trilogy, I got to say, the Tim Burton Batman,
Tire of it. Ever.
It feels like a comic book.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Like the art direction, the set direction, the score, everything about the color palette of the movie.
I know Groot is deeply going to enjoy Batman only because of how long and fucking how much you've waxed poetic about Dick Tracy. And this is like, this is pulling it back just enough for me because I fucking hate Dick Tracy.
Tracy's amazing.
It's
a stupid
movie.
No, it is a fucking living comic book.
Well, and I feel like Batman is the nice compromise between the two where it pulls it a little bit enough away from the pure comic book like come to life and gives it a little bit more realism, but it's still definitely jumping the shark with the way they're doing stuff.
Yeah.
Whereas Dick Tracy's is hard line like, hey, let's just take a comic book page and put it on fucking screen. No.
They did a great job.
I mean, I don't think I hate it as much as Hobbit is saying he hates it. I will watch the movie.
Well, it's not fucking Nickelback, but like...
not fucking Nickelback.
It's like the comic book version of What Dreams May Come. It jumps off the screen so hard.
Dick Tracy is like the fastball of comic book movies the band Fastball that did that song
My Way, whatever
the way today.
No, hey, do not compare Dick Tracy to What Dreams May Come, okay, fucker?
Yeah, no.
Hey, you watch the screen and you tell me it is not
I never
the
once
best live action like the best live action like sort of vision of an actual comic book.
Well, this
like,
took
frame.
Us all of 4 minutes to get off the rails.
I've never once watched What Dreams May Come and thought, hey, this is similar to Dick Tracy as far as it just jumps off the screen.
You know, that's the natural.
It's a gorgeous movie.
That's what you may also like on Amazon Prime is like you watch What Dreams May Come and fucking Dick Tracy shows up as the next choice.
So Tim Burton's Batman 1989.
Yep.
And then fucking Beetlejuice.
Beetlejuice.
Those are the two huge ones for me.
Absolutely.
And I will say my third in there has got to be Edward Scissorhands.
I was about to say, absolutely.
Because you want to talk about a fairy tale come to life.
Oh,
that
God.
Movie is gorgeous and everything about it is amazing.
100% agree. But I will say that out of all those movies, of course, there was a mixture. That one to me is the number one representation of Burton and Elfman just coming together
absolutely.
To make that fairy tale life. Just boom. Like,
oh, Edward Scissorhands?
Yes.
Absolutely.
Oh, my God.
I still say it's not my favorite movie he ever made, but it's his best.
Mm. I would say the music from Edward Scissorhands is probably on the top of the list for Danny Elfman compositions that makes me want to fucking cry.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
that like that soft like chorus-infused like orchestration where it's so loving and melancholy and
it's so
perfectly fits the movie.
The movie is such a like a tragedy in its own way.
Oh, it absolutely is.
But it's my favorite. It's my favorite collaboration between
him
and
now. Ellen. I just want to watch Edward Scissorhands.
Yeah, well, I mean,
it's a great fucking movie.
Oh my God,
fuck yeah, dude. And it's like 25 years old or some shit now.
And still holds the fuck up.
Oh yeah.
So, in comparison, how do we feel about the way darker tone on Batman Returns? So it was still Elfman.
It was still Elfman.
I'd say I'd still deeply love it, but not as, I mean, there's such an iconic nature to the first Batman movie he did that, like, it's really hard to even challenge that with another Batman movie.
Well, no, because they went a little more off the rails and definitely made it more dark and zany in Batman Returns. That was definitely I'm going to keep using that word, but it was a darker movie. It was a way darker movie.
It was
movie.
Darker, but it was almost kind of like a carnival at the same time.
Well, yeah. And Burton, his music always kind of reminds me of the circus anyway.
Yeah.
Elfman. Elfman, yeah. Like, it's very, very carnival-y.
Yeah.
As a rule, there's so much deep whimsy in his music that it fits.
I would definitely agree with that. And I think Elfman was involved in Big Top Pee Wee.
Well, he did Pee-wee's Big Adventure.
That's what I meant.
He did Pee-wee's Big Adventure, which I would say would be the dark horse candidate of one of the most iconic, like, Tim Burton orchestrations that he's done. I'm not saying it goes anywhere close to Beetlejuice or fucking Edward Scissorhands, but it's in that conversation.
Yeah.
But also, lesser known, he did the fucking Simpsons music.
Yes, he did.
He did the soundtrack for the Simpsons.
He's all over the screen every episode. Yeah. Danny Elfman.
Also, a lesser known, Fable. The video game series.
No shit.
He did all the music for Fable.
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah. Nice.
So, and that's beautiful. I mean, it's just this very soft, like, beautiful background music that really fits the tone incredibly well. And that had to have been a arduous process to get, like, all that different music for that big of a game.
Well, I will say this. One of the things that really impresses me about Danny Elfman is because... When you have guys like James Horner and Alan Silvestri and all these guys, they're doing kind of like movie score style, what you would expect, you know, like, and they made some great scores, but you can hear the first five notes of any Danny Elfman score and know exactly who the fuck made that music.
Absolutely. Also, I do want to point out quickly that a correction from the first part of the episode, we talked about that Hans Zimmer did Avengers, I think is what we discussed.
Yes,
that's actually Silvestri that did the Avengers movie. So before we get comments and stuff, we're flipping through, you know, notes and everything. So that is actually Alan Silvestri, who did Avengers Endgame, I think, as well. And
I do want to say, I just found this out. I had no fucking idea. I don't know how, but apparently Danny Elfman did the main score for Tales from the Crypt.
Nice. Oh, nice.
I did not know that.
But that makes sense.
Listen to it in your head now. And it's totally Danny Elfman.
Yeah.
And then he also did Nightbreed, which, makes fucking sense,
I do remember that now.
And Darkman.
Yes, he did.
I did not know that either. And I love that makes all sense, of that. I love all of that.
Yep.
Like, for some reason, it just makes it so much better now to me. I did love the music for all those, especially Darkman 2. Like, everyone loves Tales from the Crypt. I mean, I'm sorry. If not, you should.
Not Darkman 2. No, Darkman also.
was that the only time that he and Sam Raimi worked together?
I think Elfman did one Spider-Man 2. I think
he did Spider-Man, Spider-Man 2, and Spider-Man 3.
I thought he did Spider-Man. Yeah.
Army of Darkness. So that's Sam Raimi.
Oh, that's right. He was involved with that. And by the way, that is also an underappreciated. It's even mentioned in fucking High Fidelity. Well, they say Evil Dead, I think, but they were talking about Army of Darkness because that soundtrack is fucking iconic.
Yeah. Yeah, holy shit. The fucking Frighteners? I didn't know that.
Yes.
God damn it.
That's right. One of the things that I was going to bring up in a minute here, but like when you have a certain director that really pairs perfectly with a composer, we already talked about Steven Spielberg and John Williams.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Obviously, we're talking about Tim Burton and Elfman.
Sleepy Hollow, but Mars Attacks.
Elfman and Sam Raimi, too.
Yep.
Apparently.
Seriously in bed together,
but that makes sense. I mean, because I don't know anyone that likes Tim Burton but doesn't like Raimi or vice versa. Like, if you like Tim Burton, you probably also like Sam Raimi.
That's right
because they have there's way more slapstick in Raimi stuff, which I appreciate deeply, but it still has that like kind of like whimsical horror tone, like it's dark whimsy. That's what made me grow up to love horror movies and creepy shit.
Absolutely.
Is the Tim Burton stuff and the Sam Raimi stuff. So yeah, like I want to hear from a listener that likes, let's say, Tim Burton, but doesn't like Sam Raimi. I want to see if there's anyone out there that has that opinion.
That's like a stupid unicorn. That doesn't exist.
By the way, stupid unicorn is now the front runner of the name of this episode.
Stupid. Here we go. Hold on. So another surprise to me, which and another Raimi movie, and I didn't know Raimi did this, was that Oz the Great and Powerful movie that came out in 2012.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that
with,
fucking,
2013 with
that fucking dumpster fire.
I mean, I didn't think it was that bad.
I thought it was pretty bad.
Really?
No, I think it was a super hard turn in that movie.
Oh, no, there was. I know what you're talking about. There was.
Where one of the characters that is like adorable and you're like really into it, and then all of a sudden it's just like, I'm evil now, is almost as bad as fucking Revenge of the Sith with fucking Anakin.
Don't get me started.
Where it's like, I'm evil now. Fuck off.
No,
no.
I had a bad dream, so now I have to
You're talking about the witch. You're talking about
Mia Kunis.
Mia Kunis is,
fucking adorable and she's sweet.
And then she's like evil.
And then she's fucking evil, just on a fucking pin turn.
Mia Kunis is the perfect segue into my next point.
Okay.
You want to talk about directors that have paired up with each other? Darren Aronofsky and Clint Mansell.
Those soundtracks for all the Aronofsky stuff is so fucking fantastic. I want to say specifically The Fountain.
The Fountain
is incredible.
Yes.
What Clint Mansell did with the music from Swan Lake in Black Swan. With Mila Kunis.
Yeah.
That was a transition. But I mean, Requiem for a Dream and fucking like, I love Clint Mansell. He came out of, Pop Will Eat Itself, a band.
I did not know that actually. That's cool.
That was his genesis. Pop Will Eat Itself. Just like, Danny Elfman came out of Oingo Boingo.
Oh, I thought you were like saying that's like Phil Collins and Genesis. Like that was his genesis.
Oh
like,
no. Well,
Pop Will Eat Itself.
That's where he kind okay. of rose up, but he started doing film work and he's done almost everything that Darren Aronofsky's ever done.
That's great.
And he's done other stuff. I mean, he did the score for this movie High Rise by a director called Ben Wheatley.
I still haven't seen that, and I deeply want to see that. That's got a Loki, fucking
Tom Hiddleston.
Tom Hiddleston is in it, right?
It's one of my favorite movies. It was my favorite movie that came out that year. It is an amazing film. Watch it.
I haven't seen it, so I will definitely. It's on the list now.
It is. You want to talk about a movie that goes off the rails? It's like Lord of the Flies, in this high rise like apartment building with like different levels of like society. It's fucking banana. It goes so fucking off the rails. You're just your mouth is agape by the end of the movie. It's so fucking fantastic. And I bought the fucking soundtrack, like. Right after watching it, I was like, fuck yeah.
I do want to bring up a composer that I learned of from actually television and has done a lot of other stuff as well. And I know that you can probably Groots wax poetic about this composer, Bear McCreary.
Oh, dude, I was going to mention.
Yeah, that you may know him, at least where I learned from him was the 2004 reboot of Battlestar Galactica. He does the music for that.
And
oh, really?
Yep. Okay. That music was amazing. Like the music for that show was so integral in like just setting the mood, you know, like the whole miniseries where fucking humanity basically gets all but wiped out. It's sad as fuck, you know, and it's depressing as shit. But like throughout the entire series, even though it fell off at the end, I was definitely going to mention that later as just kind of like a, you know, just drop that little
nugget.
Bear McCreary, man.
Yeah. He's done a bunch of stuff. He did the music for Eureka. That was his. Battlestar Galactica. Of course, Caprica as well. Knights of Badassdom. Chillerama. Europa Report.
So good.
Defiance, the video game. He did God of War. That was his.
Oh, nice.
Ooh.
Defiance, the TV series as well, which makes sense. Constantine. Mm. The Boy, which was a horror movie that came out in 2016. Colossal, that great fucking movie.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
So fucking underrated.
Yeah.
Have you seen Colossal?
Mm-mm. I have not.
It's a darkly hilarious kaiju movie. Okay. The premise is that this drunk bitch somehow.
Played by Anne Hathaway.
Anne Hathaway. When she gets drunk and gets all kinds of crazy. On the other side of the world in Korea, a giant monster starts wrecking, like, Seoul.
Oh, no, I've just recently seen something about that movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's showing up on the streaming services, too. Like, I just haven't watched it. It's on a couple, it's on, like, Hulu and I think Netflix, or maybe Prime and Netflix. One.
Yeah, no,
It's on two different services.
I took Jody to see it in the theater when it came out, and we were so pleasantly, like, blown away by it.
So it's good. Like, the storyline, like, it's
Jason
fun.
Sudeikis, I think.
He's the other main character.
Talk about a great performance.
Oh, he's...
I ain't going to give anything away, but goddamn.
He's fantastic at that, yeah. Another one that I feel is going to be probably his new most iconic, because I've heard some of the music in the trailer. The movie coming out in 2019, Bear McCreary is the main composer, and even the trailer music is epic. I mean, it feels beautiful. Is Godzilla King of the Monsters.
Yes.
Ooh, nice. He's doing all the orchestration for that. And really? That trailer, the music is very prevalent in that trailer. I mean, it really, especially the moment that Mothra like spreads out its wings.
Oh, yeah.
And the music like crescendos at that point. This epic brass.
How about when the Hydra and Godzilla just clash on each other?
Fuck yeah.
In the trailer?
Oh,
like,
yeah.
There's the music in the background when they're just, and then, dude. God. Oh.
So I'm very intrigued to see how that music is, because it really made the trailer.
Did he do the original Godzilla?
Like, I didn't see that on the list.
Okay. I don't think so. But I will say this, just because I just remembered, it showed up yesterday in the mail, one of my Valentine's Day presents. The Tom York of Radiohead did the score for the new Suspiria.
So he's one we hear on the new in the remake.
Yes, he did all the.
That was enjoyable.
It was fantastic.
The remake was. I was hardlined against it, but that remake.
I was very very apprehensive about it, but I have to say, they made it their own thing, and it was outstanding.
That contortionist scene, holy shit!
Oh, dude, tell me about it,
dude.
Man.
That made me very uncomfortable.
Yes, it did. But I will also say that a few months ago, we were lucky enough to have Goblin. Mm,
that was so good.
Come through as a live show, and they screened the original 1977 Argento Suspiria.
Which is equally fucking amazing.
And talk about a great, like, they played the score live. I got my fucking, like, vinyl, like, of the original score.
Yeah, they took time to, like, sign anything and take pictures with anybody that wanted it. Yeah.
It was so fucking good.
And another thing coming up in Richmond in May 4th is that they're going to show the Star Wars A New Hope, and the Richmond Symphony is going to play all of John Williams' scores.
Which I need to get on getting tickets like now.
Oh, dude, I looked at nosebleeds and they were fucking expensive.
Yeah.
Oh, you know that shit's expensive.
Dude, I was like, I can't pay this for like the top and like tears,
which is
like,
why you should use our link to amazon.com
so we
can afford tickets to the Star Wars thing in May.
I will say, like, it was a million years ago, but like my mother took me and my two brothers to Wolf Trap up in northern Virginia, like this big outdoor venue, and we saw like one of these like Boston Pops like Star Wars live concerts. It was forever ago. I can't even remember when it was, but you know, it was so much fun. And of course we were younger then, so we were just over the moon about this thing.
Oh yeah.
But
which, when you're a young kid and you can get your kid excited about going to see the symphony, that's pretty big.
Oh yeah.
You know,
yeah.
That's pretty important. So
that's, all you got to do is say Star Wars and we were in.
No shit. Right.
I mean, it was literally that easy. It was that simple.
Yep.
Yeah.
I mean, it kind of is to this day, too. I'm just saying.
It really is.
You just say Star Wars. Oh, hey, what's up?
Low-hanging fruit for
dude,
us.
Dude, really.
That's honestly, if I was on a date with a girl and she's like, I'm really, really into Star Wars, I'm like, cool, fall wedding. Like, that's... like, that's... fall I mean, I'm going to forgive a lot if somebody's like a deep Star Wars nerd. It's like, cool.
Go.
Yeah. I don't know. You have... You rage punch in your sleep? Fine. That's fine.
It's
like
fine.
You like Star Wars. It's
all
cool.
All she got to say is, I love you. And you're like, oh, I know.
I know. And then she pulls out the Slave Leia bikini. I'm like, yeah, no, whatever you want.
Totally cool. Totally cool.
Wrapped around finger. Achievement unlocked.
I do want to bring in another director-composer sort of collaboration that has been very popular over the years. Wes Anderson and Mark Mothersbaugh.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Talk about really fitting the tone of the movies.
Absolutely, yeah. Rushmore, Royal Tenenbaums. But, of course, Mark Mothersbaugh came out of Devo.
Really?
Really?
That.
Yeah, that's his...
Oh, I didn't know there's that. Where the whimsy comes from.
That's his origin story. We got a lot of guys, you know, here... In the more modern era, I want to say, like, you know, post, like, John Williams and Ennio Morricone and stuff, that came out of, you know, some level of pop, popular music, you know, rock and roll bands, whatever, you know. So, I mean, we got Industrial, Pop Will Eat Itself, we got Devo, we've got fucking Oingo Boingo here, But obviously, these guys are super talented and creative, and their transition over into the film score work has been outstanding. So,
I do want to just a quick mention that the only thing that I know of that they've done of any real recognition is Stranger Things. But there's a band called Survive that does old school, like retro, like synth.
Well, they kill stuff. They fucking kill it.
It makes the fucking show.
It does.
It absolutely completely just transports you back to the 80s their retro style like synth stuff. And they were a nothing band that the Duffer Brothers just found their stuff and went, this would be perfect.
Yeah.
And now they tour the world
doing
their own stuff and also Stranger Things instrumental stuff. And they're now like a really popular band because of being featured.
They probably, they found them probably on like Bandcamp. Like we don't know if this this series is gonna take off, so we need to find someone
cheap
on the cheap. But yeah, how perfect is that?
Oh, they're fucking perfect.
I still remember the first fucking trailer for the first season, and the music was there, and I was just like, I'm in.
Yeah, I'm in. Immediately.
This could be a tire but I'm gonna watch it.
That's a show that I never skip the intro to because I always want to hear that music.
Absolutely.
Beginning of every episode, it fucking sets it up for me every fucking time, and I know this because I just went through season two again.
I'm actually in the middle of going through season two again. Yeah,
and I'm just like, nope. I'm just gonna listen to it because it's just because
that's what May.
It's coming.
I thought it was. Is it May or is it the actual summer? Is it June or July?
I think it's May.
Okay. Not soon enough.
No, not soon enough.
It's not going to be set in the fall this year, guys. So we are going to get them in shorts, apparently. It's going to be in the summer.
Well, you know.
Yeah.
Well, you know. You can't have Halloween every season.
You can.
I agree. But, you can. You know.
But I get it.
I mean, all those boys, all their nuts are dropping, so they need, you know.
Need some room.
Yeah.
So, and I gotta bring this out. I know we're getting close here, but a man who does not need a composer to mix with his directing, we gotta talk about John Carpenter because
absolutely
he's not only is he director, he is composer. I mean, we talk about the themes he's created. You got fucking Halloween. Guys, come on. You hear that music. Anybody hears that music, they know Michael Myers. Like even if you're not into it. You know, as they say, like, you're not into horror, you're not into film or, you know, composers. Like, you hear that theme music and you know what it means.
Absolutely. Yeah.
You know, and how many people can do that, right?
Not many.
Exactly.
Well, also, I love John Carpenter being like, hey, I'm going to direct this movie, but I need music that's the proper fit. Fuck it, I'll do it myself.
And he sits at a piano and then he decides to go on a fifth note, and that's where we get the din, 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 din. Yep. And he just comes off with a fifth note, and then bam, we get the iconic fucking Halloween theme.
What was the name of his band who did the Big Trouble in Little China song? It was something like
I don't remember the name of the band, but I do know he was involved with that.
Something like the Pink Cadillacs or something. Like, I can't remember.
Some crazy shit.
But
Big Trouble in Little China. There you go.
How fucking fun was that?
Right?
And of course, the one time that he didn't do his own music was The Thing.
Yeah, but that I get that though, because that the music that the composer he picked for The Thing really fit The Thing though.
Do you know who it was?
I do not.
Ennio Morricone.
It was Morricone. It was
Morricone.
Holy shit.
I did know that. Yeah.
There you go. Hey, way to bring it back.
Boom.
Back around full circle.
Absolutely.
It's like, yeah, if you're not gonna do it yourself, because obviously he can. We all know
he could. Yeah, he could. He could.
But it was worth it.
I think with that movie, it came down to, like, I am so busy trying to figure out the special effects shit and getting it to fucking splice it and get it to look right.
And it's cold as fuck where we're shooting right now. Yeah.
He's like, I'm not even fucking with this, guys. You take it.
It's too cold. I can't do it.
I heard everybody was burnt out in that movie, though.
Another composer that I definitely want to bring up is the composer that did Game of Thrones.
Yes.
But we did not say,
Who the fuck is it?
I don't know John Carpenter. He also did The Fog. That was his.
Yep.
Assault on Precinct 13, yep. Escape from New York.
Escape from New York, In the Mouth of Madness.
Escape from LA.
He did the score for that. That's not Hobbit. Damn you.
Well, that movie was more just a collection of, soundtrack.
It was fodder. That movie was fodder. Christine.
The soundtrack was cool.
No, Escape from LA was a collection of trash just like LA is.
Yeah.
Ba-da-boom.
Well, that is.
But he also did.
Unless it's, 2049, and then that's San Diego is the collection of trash.
He also composed music on Christine as well as Halloween 3. Even though he wasn't his movie, he did write and compose the music for Halloween 3.
Okay.
Fuck yeah, dude.
As well as Halloween 2, obviously. It was his movie. Prince of Darkness, They Live. Like, every movie he fucking...
And it's iconic soundtracks. I mean, yeah. you can hear the music and know exactly what movie it comes from. It's not forgettable by any stretch of the imagination.
And I don't know if I mentioned this to you or not, or anybody, either of you two here, but his son is kind of taken in his steps. Like, there is that horror anthology series where it was all different Masters of Horror.
Yeah.
Well, John Carpenter's Cigarette Burn.
Oh, great, yeah. Great.
With what's his face? Daryl Dixon, whatever the fuck the actor's name is.
Norman Reedus.
Norman Reedus.
Mm-hmm.
He's the main character in that, but his son, John Carpenter's son, does the soundtrack for that fucking episode.
That's awesome. Nice. I did not know
it's
that.
It's like Corey Carpenter or something like that, I think his name is.
Yeah. Corey Carpenter sounds like an 80s boy band like member.
I swear, I think it's Corey. I think it begins with a C. But anyway, it's cool. It's cool to see, like, so his dad's directing and his son's kind of taking on in his steps, you know, like,
yeah, dude.
Just that, you know. Cigarette Burns is probably my favorite out of both volumes of that, because there's two seasons. Cigarette Burns is probably still my favorite of that fucking series.
Ooh, that's up there, definitely. But also, Screwfly Solution was really good.
Ooh, what was the one set in
Japan?
Japan, yeah.
The Takashi Miike one.
Imprint. That one was so fucked. Holy shit! Yeah.
It's Takashi Miike. Yeah. So
we've all seen Ichi the Killer. Yeah.
Oh, or Audition.
Or Audition.
Oh, Audition. Yeah.
Fucking Gozu, I think was.
Oh, dude, he's done a million movies.
Happiness of the Katakuri. Yeah, literally done 100 movies.
How can you have that much gore in your life?
I still haven't seen the newest one, the Immortal Blade or whatever.
Something like that.
Yeah.
I haven't either. I mean, he literally just has too many movies.
Yeah.
Like, fuck you, stop.
Yeah. No, but don't. But seriously,
don't stop. Don't stop.
No, keep making crazy-ass Yakuza films and shit like that, but... You made too many. I can't catch up.
Yeah, right.
There's only so much time for all this content.
Now, we're at the tail end here. I did want to bring up, we mentioned Game of Thrones.
Fuck yeah, Game of Thrones. And Westworld.
And that's where I want to... Ramin Djawadi is the composer that does the Game of Thrones soundtrack. He's also done a few more things that you may have been familiar with, like Westworld.
Wait, this is the same composer?
He does this...
Oh! Score!
Yeah, nice. He does that. He did Wrinkle in Time, Slender Man, the Ooh. Jack Ryan series on Amazon.
That does have a good score.
Prison Break, The Strain.
Ooh, I like The Strain. I do like The Strain score.
He did that fantastic Matt Damon vehicle, The Great Wall.
Well, they can't all be winners.
Apparently not.
He did Warcraft, Dracula Untold.
Nope.
Pacific Rim.
Okay, I'll take that.
That is a good score.
I did enjoy that. Yeah. I did not see the second one because...
No, it's good. Watch it. It's horrible.
It's not terrible. It's not nearly as good as the first one.
It just looked like a Power Rangers movie compared to the first one.
Not terribly far off, but way more, I don't know, like cyborgy stuff happening than...
And John Boyega kind of saves the movie. Honestly.
But also, and this is the little pin at the end of this guy, he did the original Iron Man. He was the first Ooh. Composer to nice. Touch a Marvel... property in
Hell
the new
yeah.
MCU.
In the MCU.
Yeah. Yeah.
I like it.
Same composer as Game of Thrones. So that's like fucking it. Cool.
Good for him, man.
Yeah.
They roughly came out kind of the same time.
Pretty close
First Game of Thrones was like 2009, 2010.
Nice.
It was May of 2010.
So it might have been his work on Iron Man that got him the role. Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
That's, holy shit. That's really cool.
Little history tidbit there. Yeah, I like that. Yeah.
I wouldn't be a fan if I didn't mention one of my other favorite collaborations. John Hillcoat is the director. Who has worked with Nick Cave and Warren Ellis a million times with The Proposition, The Road, fucking, he didn't direct it, but The Assassination of Jesse James, which is one of my favorite neo-westerns.
Did you Lawless as well?
He did.
Okay.
He did Lawless? Wait.
Yeah.
With
Nick Cave and Warren Ellis have done so much.
Well, that was a Hillcoat picture as well.
It was.
Lawless. Well, yeah. I'm talking about Lawless with Tom Hardy and...
Yep.
What?
Yeah, nice. Nick Cave wrote that movie.
Yeah.
Wait, Nick Cave wrote that?
Nick Cave wrote The Proposition, and he wrote Lawless.
Yeah.
The basis for, like the screenplay for Lawless.
And
that was Nick Cave.
And he did all the music with Warren Ellis, one of the other Bad Seeds.
Fuck me, running.
Dude, their scores are gorgeous. They are so,
I like Nick Cave's, like, I know, prolific songwriter and all that stuff. That's not enough for me. I'm going to fucking do these amazing soundtracks and also, I don't know, write these unbelievably good fucking movies.
About, like, well, that's a biopic, basically. I mean, it's Franklin, Virginia. It's based on a real story. Like, that was the Bootleg County in Virginia.
Amazing.
Like, I love that movie. I had no idea that Nick Cave wrote that.
Have you seen The Proposition?
I have not.
Dude.
Fantastic.
You want to talk about a hardcore movie. All right, you've seen The Road, right?
Yes, and it makes me feel really bad every time I watch it.
Every time.
Exactly.
Every fucking time.
But the score is beautiful in the road, and it just perfectly, like, every bit of music, like ties up with, like, the theme, which is, like, bleak fucking, like, despair, you know, in the whole fucking movie. It's sad as fuck. But The Proposition, one of my favorite movies coming out of Australia, and it's so fucking brutal.
It is.
It's fucking unbelievable. Watch that movie. The score is beautiful.
To the point where there was even a riff in Deadpool 2 about it, where they were talking about, I have a proposition, and they're like, okay, who's going to go first? Let's all go all together. And then the taxi driver is like, the proposition has a wonderful Guy Pearce performance. joke. Which it does, actually.
It really does.
He does great.
Well, see, for me, it's like, I don't know. I feel like Lawless had a really good mix of the darkness and the violence.
Yes.
As well as good story. Because
it really
when
did.
It was dark, it was dark. Like, whenever Tom Hardy put on those brass knuckles, you're like, oh, I'm about to see some shit. And every time you put them on, you saw someone's face get fucking caved in.
Yeah.
Or a dude's choking on his own fucking blood because he broke his fucking... He hit him in the fucking throat.
It actually reminds me a little bit of the main character in Letterkenny. is Tom Hardy in Lawless, where he doesn't talk a lot, but when he does, he means what he says, and he will fuck you up.
Yep. And Cave and Ellis, they've done a bunch of work. Like, when I was going through, not a couple weeks ago, but they did this new movie, was it War or something with Brad Pitt, the Netflix movie?
Yeah, it came out like last year or the year before. I remember trailers for that,
Where he plays like the
longer, like
general or something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's like he did that, they did that, they did the documentary West of Memphis, which was like a follow-up kind of later documentary to the West Memphis 3.
Oh, okay.
Which came out just like a couple years ago. They do just beautiful work. And I know they've been nominated. I think they were nominated for Assassination of Jesse James, which is one of my favorite, like, new Westerns. Like, after Unforgiven, it's that movie.
And that soundtrack is gorgeous.
It's beautiful.
Yeah.
It is so, like, moving, and just like they do a great job. So if I didn't mention them, I would have been remiss.
Fair enough. And now that is a good way to kind of end this episode of Geeks Under the Influence. I do want to, like, call myself out a little bit, that one soundtrack that I actually deeply enjoy the music for, and it hurts my feelings, my own feelings, to say this, but Into the Wild is a great soundtrack.
And why do you hate to admit it?
Because it was done by one Eddie Vedder.
Yeah,
and
but you know what?
I deeply hate Pearl Jam.
But it's an amazing fucking soundtrack.
And, you know, like, I don't want to be so one-sided about my hatred for something that I'm not willing to admit when there's something actually that good that comes out of it. I fucking hate Eddie Vedder and Pearl Jam. But Into the Wild is a solid fucking soundtrack, and I can't deny that. You know, right. I would be a liar. I'd be lying to myself and others if I, you know, didn't.
Because I agree, that movie was amazing, and I don't know what made them pick him or what he had going on.
Did
but a like
fantastic job.
Fucking hey, it mixes so well. Jesus Christ!
Credit where credit is due. Yeah. That he does a fantastic job with that soundtrack.
So, how about before we sign off, we just pick one movie, kind of, that maybe we haven't even mentioned or whatever, just out off the ends of our brain, that we just really enjoyed the score of.
Ooh, okay.
We haven't mentioned it, but I'm going to go with Cry Little Sister, Lost Boys.
Oh, yeah.
Woo!
Yeah, all right.
I mean, I'm just saying. And then then the Echo and the Bunnymen's cover, People Are Strange, is always fun with that.
Oh, yeah, dude.
Yeah.
Yeah. Nice. Yeah.
I will have to say, the movie is... you know, created a genre, but Riz Ortolani's fucking score for Cannibal Holocaust.
Oh, good call.
Such a juxtaposition.
Wow. Good fucking call.
It's because it's just this, like, classical guitar. Ding, 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 ding. It's so calming and everything. And meanwhile, people are getting fucking et.
Well, that kind of goes back to, like, what about the Return of the Living Dead score?
Sure.
Well, we're talking like music compilations at this point. With
Riz Ortolani. He composed that whole soundtrack.
Oh, okay.
So yeah, I'm not talking about we can get into it with the other piece, but you know, obviously, like someone like Quentin Tarantino, who's a huge fan, of film scores, has put pieces of like Ennio Morricone and all these other like Italian, '70s like composers. Bits of their themes and scores throughout all of his movies. And I'm not even talking about like the actual songs that have been in his movies, like Silhouette of Doom in Kill Bill 2, that's an Ennio Morricone piece from like the mid 70s, you know? And then he tapped Morricone and he got him to come out of fucking retirement to do The Hateful Eight,
which is also a fantastic score.
I'm like, fucking mad respect, Mr. Tarantino. Like, you are the kind of fanboy.
Yeah.
That
when a fan is actually making the film. Yeah.
He just figured out how to make millions of dollars being a fanboy.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
If seriously. I could do that, I'd be golden.
I do want to, for mine, I want to double back to Goblin. Because, of course, Suspiria is absolutely fantastic, but they also did work on Dawn of the Dead, the Romero flick.
Yep.
And is stunning. Goblin did, there was a lot of Argento flicks that Goblin was involved
in. They did Phenomena, Creepers, I think.
Yeah.
And, yeah, a bunch of stuff. Like, they're all over the place. Tenebrae, Deep Red.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I definitely want to give it up to Goblin a little bit more. Just definitely another nod to. It was phenomenal to see, like, a version of the band doing their thing to Suspiria, but I mean, they've done way more than just Suspiria, so definitely worth a listen, digging into their you know, backlog of stuff.
Fuck yeah. Sometimes prog rock is what you need for some weird ass, like, 70s psychedelic giallo
shit.
Accent.
Yeah, no shit. So we're at the end of this episode. Thank you so much for listening to our waxing poetic about composers and soundtracks. We're gonna follow up next week with GY Nights about compilation soundtracks, you know, where they somebody compiles music, like we mentioned James Gunn with the Guardian soundtrack, that kind of thing. So we're going to dig into that on next week on GUI Nights, and then we're going to follow up after that with another episode of Geeks Under the Influence. After that, every other week you're getting a GUI moving into 2019, so I'm really happy to get on a regular schedule again.
Fuck
with
yeah.
Geeks Under the Influence, and I hopefully you are as well. Follow us all of the stuff we do on the network at GUIpodcast.com. Come to Trivia Nights every first and third Monday at Fallout to hang out with me and just play some goofy-ass nerdy trivia. It's always a damn good time, and there's always a good crowd, too. And we'll find you here next week for another episode of GUI Nights next week, and then week after, Geeks Under the Influence. I am Mike the Hobbit, and as always, join us or die.
Shut the fuck up, Hobbit.
I guess.
Join us or die! Join us or die, or I will swallow your soul. Necronomicon gives us power to rise from the dead. You play to take, our play begins to spread. You can fight all you want, cause you don't you resist. We're here to take the world and rule with an iron fist. So join us or die, join us or die, or I will swallow your soul.
GUIpodcast.com.
Thank you.